Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
With stage 4 cancer, my bones are trying to kill me. They plan, they scheme, they dream that I'll be low at 6 feet. Let's talk of chemo cocktails that taste like milkweed. And how our doctors coded life upside down for me. My nosy boobs get involved in all my body parts. Spine, liver, skull, face, niche just like a knock. As I fight for my life, my boobs try to warn me. Your stage 4, your time is now time to perform.
Welcome to My Boobs Are Trying to Kill Me, a podcast brought to you by stand-up, speak-up founder Carla Stevens Tolstoy, who shares with us the journey of her life with stage 4 cancer and the amazing individuals that inspire her along the way. Today, Carla sits down with Sandra Dowick, a parenting solutions practitioner specializing in behavioral development and yoga therapy. Sandra shares with us how she was able to overcome a difficult childhood and how raising her sons with several health issues became a calling to help others. Despite the odds, Sandra believes she is not a victim, but a warrior.
How Sandra and I met is that, as my listeners know from my first episode, is that I'm battling stage 4 breast cancer, which has metastasized throughout my spine into my bones. And I was having trouble with mobility, but I was also having a lot of trouble with anger and depression and just not really being very good at mindfulness. And so I got connected with Sandra through my nursing company, actually Nurse Next Door. And right then I knew that I had a real angel here on my hands and who has had such an amazing life journey. And when she told me her story, I was really blown away because I just thought, wow, I'm just battling a physical ailment. And I think battling a mental ailment is 100 times harder. And so it inspired me to think, wow, if she can push through all this and come out the other side ahead, then so can I. Because I have way more support than she ever had. And I think I talk about this a lot in my old podcast, is the concept of love privilege, which I believe that we have gender privilege, we have white privilege.
There's so many, but definitely.
Ageism, I guess. Wealth privilege.
Yeah, wealth, yes.
And a lot of people talk about those all the time, but nobody talks about love privilege. Mm. And I believe that if, as a child, you are loved unconditionally, and you are shown how to love others, your chance at leading a happy, joyful life is probably 1,000 times greater. Easier. Mm-hmm. And what struck me about Sandra is she is someone that gives so much love and has embraced love, but she didn't have any love basically as a child.
Right.
So she had to learn how to do all those things on her own, which I think is pretty miraculous. So I really want Sandra to tell her story, even starting off with what your childhood was like.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a small town just outside of London, Ontario, and I lived with my brother, my father, and my mother. My mother, she was born with some sort of mental disability herself. So from what I was told, she was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around her neck, which caused her to lose oxygen to her brain. So my mother's mental capability is pretty low. She functions at a pretty low level. So growing up, I never really had the mother bond that I witnessed with a lot of my peers.
Did she have any bond with her own mother?
I think she did. I don't know to what extent. I never saw it. I was really young when her mother passed away, so I'm not very knowledgeable when it comes to that. She had a difficult life, I'm sure, having these mental and physical, if you will, conditions. She did come from a very loving family. Her brothers and sisters are all very loving and caring towards her. And I actually found out when I was 16 that my mother was date raped. And she became pregnant at the age of 17. She was put into a special home for women, girls, I should say, teenagers, that for teenage pregnancies. And my mom's background is Jewish, so very strict, and abortion was not even an option. So,
and was that, which baby was that that she
so
had?
So that was my eldest sister that I only found out about her when I was 16 years old.
Oh, she didn't raise her?
No, she did not.
Okay, so she went into the home and had to give her up.
She had to give her up immediately.
Horribly traumatic.
Yes, I'm sure it was. No, not at all. So she was 17. She gave up this baby, and she's, I'm now close to her. But yeah, I couldn't even imagine giving up this baby. And again, keep in mind, though, is that
did she go to a good home?
She did.
Okay.
And it's interesting because when I found out about my sister and I heard about her upbringing, as much as I'm sure it was really difficult for her to know that she was adopted, put up for adoption, she was very fortunate to go to a really good family who I actually felt jealous about.
Of course.
When I heard her story, because she had this amazing mom who she was really close to. And don't get me wrong, it's not that I didn't have an amazing mother. I did. It's just she didn't have the capability to raise me like the average mother, mm-hmm. if you will.
Well, she had disabilities.
She had the disabilities.
A huge disadvantage to be
it
being
is.
A good mom.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, she tried in her own little way. She tried to compensate for my father a lot by simply buying me treats, right? It was her way of showing love towards me and doing things for me. But very mechanical. So my dad, he was raised in a small town at the time, which is Innisfil, so just outside of Barrie, Ontario. And he had 9 other siblings. So he actually had, I believe, 11, I want to say, siblings before 2 had passed away at a very young age. So he came from a home, a father himself, that was very strict. A lot of abuse. There was a lot of discipline. And so he didn't have a very good childhood himself, from my understanding. And I've never really gotten to complete detail because, to be honest, I never really became close to my grandparents. I heard a lot of horror stories. I think you live with that sort of fear of not really wanting to ask a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I did see my grandparents, it was fine and everything was kosher, if you will. But my father, from my understanding, and I don't know the whole story as to what happened, but I know that he developed, I guess, at a young age, what was known as OCD. So everything had to be perfect. From my understanding, there was a lot of rage. So my father was put into a home, a mental institution. And what I know is that my mother was put into something similar.
So you have 2 parents, they're dealing with mental health issues. Very different mental health issues.
Very different.
I wonder what drew them to
together. They met on a bus. You know, from what I've heard from my mother's sister is that they did meet on a bus on their way back to their facility.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And were either of them educated?
No.
So no education.
No education at all.
And what would you say their intellectual capabilities
my
were
dad's
for intellectual conversations?
Street smarts.
Okay.
Was higher.
Yes.
You could have a pretty good conversation with my father. My mother, not at all. Could not have any political conversation with her. I could never approach her when it came to schoolwork. She had no knowledge whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I would have to read things to her, have to spell things for her.
I mean, that's hard. Like, I just took for granted that if my parents couldn't help me with my schoolwork, I had tutors or I had someone to help me or, you know, did you go to to teachers for help? You were just embarrassed.
No,
you were
just like, embarrassed. I'm just gonna... The teacher started to catch on. I think it was grade 1. And my dad never dealt with any of his issues growing up and the OCD that he had. And unfortunately, it became quite severe, especially, I would presume, after he had kids, because...
You can't control kids.
No, and I don't think he liked kids very much.
Yeah, because you can't control
them,
right?
They're dirty.
Yeah, they're dirty, messy. They're loud.
And for somebody who is so OCD, to have children in your home would be very difficult. Everything was covered in plastic. The couches were covered in plastic. You couldn't sit on the furniture. You couldn't touch the walls. You couldn't use the sink even after the bathroom to wash your hands because there'd be water marks in the sink.
How did you live like that?
That's all I knew.
So you just thought,
it was
okay,
so
this
difficult, but I'll tell you, I did think it was normal, but my dad had this routine where he would wake up every Sunday morning, and as family, you would have to clean the house. And I'm not just talking clean the house, I'm talking clean the house.
Like scrub it clean.
Scrub it clean. And like, I would be in charge of cleaning the toilet, and I remember he would say, no, 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 that's not the way you do it. And he'd bring in a toothbrush, and I'd have to get the toothbrush under the rim. And, you know, to vacuum the carpet, you couldn't just use a normal vacuum cleaner where you'd push it. You'd actually have to use the hose of the vacuum cleaner, so you're on the ground getting every single piece of the carpet.
And who rebelled out of the kids?
I did.
So you were the one that would say, I don't want to do housework on a Sunday.
I rebelled, but it wasn't pretty if you did.
So what would happen?
You would get whipped with the belt, and what he would do is he would count, and it would be to the age. So however old you were is how many hits you would get with the belt, and you knew you were going to get hit with the belt because he would make this cracking noise, like with this belt. So that's how he would sort of warm up with it, and then he would whack you with the belt.
What
across your bum and your backside as well. It hurt. Really hurt. And that's a pain that you will never forget. And I remember that if it was going to happen to myself or my brother, I would try to put on as many underwears as I could. If I heard the belt going, I would just try as hard as I could to get underwear on, or more on, so that it wouldn't hurt as much. But you know, and then he would feel
scar? Like, did you ever?
Oh yeah, there would be bruises and scars and lines. And I remember going to school and having a really difficult time sitting in my chair at school. And I remember the teacher's name, Mrs. Wolanski at the time, is where she would catch on. She was starting to catch on. She was like seeing that I was really fidgety and I was constantly biting my nails because I guess I was so nervous. And she would always ask me, are you okay? Are you okay? Like, what's going on? And nothing really done about it back then, right?
But what I've heard from, you know, a lot of kids that I've talked over the years, and adults, they're angry that no adult stepped in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that nobody stood up for them.
Yep.
But it's hard to stand up for someone, for another person's child, because it's not seen as appropriate, or you could be wrong, or that's just better to look the other direction, you know?
Yes.
And we're going to get to that part later, because we're going to talk a little bit about how you
plays
do stand
a significant
up
role
and,
in my
yes,
life now,
your life
and
now.
Why I'm so involved with children. Yes.
Yeah, because that's important to you. But
despite his mental health setbacks, Sandra's father managed a sandwich shop. Her uncle also worked at the shop and so moved in to their family home. This is when Sandra's uncle began to sexually abuse her. She shares with us now how these events shaped her childhood. Please be advised, Sandra's account contains graphic descriptions.
So, yeah, so next to my dad having his issues and being abusive, both, I guess you would say, mentally, emotionally, and physically, towards myself, my brother, you know, still in denial a little bit about it, my mother as well. My uncle, he came and he lived with us. And he actually worked for my dad at the sub store. And I was in kindergarten, I think it was SK or even grade one, barely young anyway. And is when it all began, and that's when the sexual abuse began. And that was my uncle that started. And I remember one day, my mom wasn't home, so my mom would leave the house quite frequently during the day, and she would go for walks. So she would always take day tours. She obviously didn't drive, and she would be gone for a couple hours. And typically, that's when she went to go buy me the candy. And I remember him starting in the dining room, and he would lie me on the ground, and that's when he would pull down my pants and he would start masturbating, and to the point where he finished on me. And I remember him telling me that he was urinating at the end but I always remembered it being warm. And then I remember him cleaning it up with paper towel at the end. And then I did get a little bit more where he was trying to get a little bit closer and closer and closer to my vagina. Being very young, it was hard to obviously put it all the way, inserting it in. Do you remember it getting a lot and a lot closer? It would happen quite frequently. So when my mom would go out, he would do it there inside of our dining room. And then we had a neighbor, and his name was Jeff, and he would feed his fish when he was gone. I guess he went away for work a lot, and he would take me over there, and he would do it there to me as well. And, you know, it was really hard, but it's interesting because as a little girl, you don't know what's happening and you can't even really wrap your head around it. What you do know, though, is that you're being shown love.
Yes.
I was getting so much attention from him that it actually felt good.
Yes.
Right?
Because you thought that was how someone shows love. Because probably afterwards, he was very sweet.
Very sweet. And I remember him telling me that if I told anybody, that I would be the one that got into trouble, which is something that a lot of children are told.
Yeah.
And you believe it. Because the last thing you want is to get in trouble from an authority figure of some description, whether it be a teacher or a parent or a guardian of some sort, or, you know, even the police. Like, you don't turn to that because you really believe.
And
for me, trouble, oh my gosh, me getting in trouble, that involves a belt.
Well, and also, you know, the system wasn't properly set up to even know how to deal with a situation like yours.
Yeah.
So they remove you from your home. They put you in probably not a great foster home.
Right.
And then you become a runaway.
Yes.
And it just continues on. So there's not a lot of options for kids, which is even sadder.
No, there isn't a lot of options. And it was really difficult. So things continued the way that it was, you know, inside my home with my dad being the way that he was. He was definitely very abusive towards my mother. He would hit her a lot. And
what
would she scream and cry. She really couldn't go anywhere. I remember he would drop her off. We lived in a forest behind her home. And I remember he would drop her off in the middle of the forest and make her find her way out. And I remember crying one night. And we did eventually have another uncle move into our house. And he was completely opposite from my other uncle. Never once laid his hand on me. He was with us, though, unfortunately, for a very short period of time.
Do you think he knew what was happening in the house?
I don't know. Oh, no, yes, he did definitely know that the abuse was there with my mother. They all witnessed it.
Yes.
With us. They all witnessed that. Nobody knew about the sexual abuse with my uncle. That was hidden between my uncle and I. However, I remember one day I was lying on the couch with my other uncle. And because this happened quite frequently with my other uncle is that I actually did start touching his penis. And I remember him taking my hand and saying, "What are you doing?" No. And nothing was said out of it. It was left. And maybe he just thought I was curious.
Yeah, I mean, people weren't educated back then to know, right?
No.
And he might not want to have dealt with it.
No, and I don't blame him because with that family, I probably wouldn't have either at that time. So he did actually talk to me about it. And it's interesting because it's after it stopped, a few years after we had moved to Toronto. I was 16. I remember it clearly because I actually had a boyfriend. And, you know, it's interesting because I know if I were to contact this boyfriend, which I never did, and I know that he would, you know, say 100% that this happened. And we were in the car and him and I were driving my uncle to the bus station. And he brought it up and he said, "Did Sandra ever tell you what I did?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well, I just want Sandra to know that I'm sorry and that I want her to know that the only reason why I did it was because it happened to me." And it was sort of explained a little bit more to my boyfriend at the time that he did sexually abuse me. But we didn't really talk about it after. That was just it. It was sort of left because it was hard because I hadn't really talked about it. I didn't really deal with any of this. And I had a lot of anger issues, even at that time, towards my boyfriend at the time. Like, I felt like I always needed him to be around. I was jealous over the smallest little things. Even at the young age of 16, I would scream at him all the time.
Were you angry? Did you want your boyfriend to stop the car? Pull the uncle out and just beat the living shit out of him?
I nothing was going through my head at that time.
Well, you probably in a state of shock.
I was.
By saying it happened to him.
Justifying me.
He's trying to justify himself, which bad shit happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't excuse the fact that
you have to deal with it.
Yeah. That you in turn do bad shit to other people. I mean, maybe it makes you have a better understanding of the situation, and maybe a little bit more empathy towards it. But if he knew what he was doing that was wrong, he could have gone to get help.
Totally.
He didn't
have to choose.
Keep abusing.
That's
a choice.
That's 100%, hands down, a choice. Because the cycle needs to stop somewhere.
Cycle needs to stop. Yes. And that's something that I think that I find amazing and so inspiring about you is it stopped.
It did.
It stopped with you.
Yes.
And not only has it stopped with you, you continue to advocate for others to make sure it stops even before it happens or before it gets out of control with families.
Yeah. So I don't consider myself a victim.
What do you call yourself?
A warrior. A warrior. I'm a warrior. I'm not a victim. A victim is somebody that can't move on.
I mean, based on your stories and what you've been through, I mean, it's amazing that you're sitting here now and you're in a happy, loving relationship.
Happy place. Yeah, and it wasn't always like that.
And it wasn't always like that.
It wasn't always like that. And I was not an easy person to be around by no means. So as I said, I did rebel. I left home. I left home at the age of 16 years old, 17 years old. And I had to try to make a living. And I had to make it on my own. So I actually moved in with a roommate at the time.
How old were you now?
Got some jobs, 17 years 17. Old. Reconnected with another uncle of mine and lived with him for a short period of time. And then that's when I actually met my ex-husband. I was 19 years old, actually. It was my first time actually going to a bar. It's called the 55 Special. It was in Barrie, and he was a doorman. And he ID'd me. And he ended up asking me for my number that night. And I was attracted to him. And we ended up connecting. We ended up moving in together shortly after that, only to find out after we had moved in together that he was 10 years older than me.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did not know that.
Like 10 years mean good, 10 years. Good news or 10 years
well,
being
I mean,
not
it was
news.
A shock, right? Because here I am 19 years old and he's telling me that he's 30. I think he had
that
he's turned
so old.
30. I'm like, you're 30? I'm 19.
Yes, okay.
But it's interesting because he actually wrote me a letter because he said that he was trying to figure out how he could tell me his age. Anyway, he did. But I was okay with it.
Yeah.
I was okay. I mean, we had already fallen for each other. And it's interesting because I think maybe I did more so because he had the maturity.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was self-sufficient to some degree.
Yes.
He had the smarts. And maybe I was falling in love with him for different reasons than the average 19-year-old would.
Well, you're not the average 19-year-old,
no,
right?
No, I'm not. So maybe I'm falling in love, and as quirky as this may sound, as a father figure.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, we were together. We're living in London. He's, you know, we're running these businesses. And he's always been an entrepreneur. And, like, you know, everything was fine. I didn't really show my true colors. I didn't really talk about my past as much as I probably should have. But I hid a lot of it. And at 21 years old, I had my first baby. So along
She didn't go to college.
So I ended up going back, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I did. I was finishing my schooling at the time after I left home, but after I had Nathan is when I did go back. And during my years of 19, actually, and living in Barrie, when I had met my ex-husband, I was actually going to Georgian College, and I was doing my ECE at the time. Yeah, so I was actually working at the Barrie Advance newspaper during the day. And in distribution, and then in advertising. And then I was going to Georgian doing my ECE.
So
I got into Georgian Georgian college based on maturity, being an adult. So motherhood. Here comes motherhood at 21 years old, and I'm still the child myself. Haven't dealt with any of my past at all, and I get pregnant, and I think I'm going to have this baby, and everything's going to be wonderful. And finally, somebody who's going to love me unconditionally.
Yes.
And that's the first thing that sort of goes through your head. This is your baby.
Yes, of course.
This baby can't leave you. It's yours. It's with you 24/7. Yeah. It's going to love you unconditionally. And, but wow, was that ever a shocker. 21, so he's born colicky, and he's so hard to deal with, and postpartum depression kicks in for me, and all my true colors start coming out. So I'm now a very angry mother. I am just like, what happened? I don't want this baby. This is too much to handle. Taking it out completely on my ex-husband at the time, angry and throwing things and hitting, and everything that I was brought up with is coming out in me.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to deal with. And it's no excuse at the time that I look at it now, is you don't know any better.
Postpartum depression wasn't really well known back then. I mean,
21 years ago, it wasn't.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like it was just seen as, like, get your shit under control and just love motherhood.
I remember I got out of control one day, and he took me to a doctor, and he said, I'm scared she's going to take her life. I'm scared she's going to take her life, and I don't know what she's going to do to even the baby. And I, you know, never hurt Nathan, but I was always wanting to hurt myself. And they wanted to take me away, and he wanted to put me into a special home for me to get help. And I refused, and I said that I wanted to try to figure this out all by myself. But still, it was still really difficult, and to the point where he would never be around, and our relationship was pretty much going sour. Even at that time. Then I got pregnant again. I got pregnant with my second child. Nathan's, Nathan's 18 months old. Joshua is diagnosed with GERD to the point where it's really severe. He's completely malnutritioned. He can't keep any food down. Formula, I tried nursing him and everything. So eventually we ended up relocating to Toronto based on my ex-husband's company. He actually went into business with his brother. So we relocated in Toronto, which was a really good thing because we were able to be seen by Sick Kids Hospital. London's knowledgeable, granted, but Sick Kids Hospital was where we really needed to be. So Joshua, he's seen by a doctor, and they do all these tests to find out that it's pretty bad. It's affecting his lungs. He had esophagitis, which the stage after that is esophageal cancer. So he has nothing left to his lungs. And so we know that we have to do surgery. So at the age of 3.5, almost 4, he has what's called a fundoplication and a pleuroplasty done. So basically they are redoing his whole stomach so that contents cannot come up, because everything was constantly coming up and going into his lungs, which is really dangerous because he was constantly getting aspiration pneumonia.
And that's so hard to look at your child see that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Carla Stevens Tolstoy interviewing Parenting Solutions practitioner Sandra Dowick. With two children under 2 years old, both with severe lingering health issues, Sandra faces her toughest struggle yet, caring for her children and tackling her past in order to survive.
So you're dealing with something pretty traumatic on
with
one
my
side,
son.
And then you've got your other son.
Yeah, so then I have my other son, who, as I said, was very colicky. Something just didn't seem right to me. He was very high strung. He had a lot of tempers, and of course I think, well, maybe it's inherited, right? So we end up, it's interesting, because we end up going away to this cottage in Marisalva Beach, and I remember with my ex-sister-in-law at the time, and she turns to me and she says that her friend, I guess, who is some sort of psychologist or whatever, says, does Sandra know that her son has autism? And she said that to me. And of course, I have absolutely no idea what autism even is. So in school, I end up bringing this up to his teacher, who has brought up to me on different occasions that Nathan is here physically, but he's not here mentally. His mind is wandering. He's
learning disabilities.
Yeah, they don't know, you know, what's going on. I've been to doctor and they're like, he'll grow out of it. He'll grow out of it.
Just a quick interjection. I'm Zach Tolstoy, one of the founders of Stand Up Speak Up. Our podcast is just one part of the Stand Up Speak Up brand. We are supported by an online store of the same name where we sell a variety of artisan products. We have an ongoing blog series with over a dozen contributors, and we offer a series of interactive workshops. Throughout the different iterations of Stand Up Speak Up, our core message and purpose have always been the same.
to create a site that allows our customers and us more opportunities to speak up about and support causes, organizations, and groups that we're passionate about, and that of course could use additional support. My mother and I have learned about allyship over the years from what feels like 1,001 places and people. We want to encourage members of this fantastic Stand Up Speak Up community to come along and learn with us. So along with our team, we created this workshop featuring videos, articles, and exercises that have really helped the two of us in our own journey towards allyship. Don't worry, it doesn't cost any money, and you don't need to make an account to access the information. We wanted to make our workshop as accessible as possible because we believe in our message and understand the importance of spreading awareness. The Ally Workshop is split into 8 parts, including interactive quizzes and helpful videos. It's intended to introduce you to new skills and courses of action in the world of allyship. The workshop is easy to use and can be done entirely on your cell phone, tablet, or computer at your own pace, with each of the 8 sections taking an average of about 15 minutes or so to complete, or a breezy couple hours on a Sunday afternoon.
So you're at a stage where you had a pretty shitty childhood.
Yes.
And there's even a million more stories from your childhood.
We're just
taking a few of them to give a glimpse.
Yeah.
And then you think, okay, I'm going to get married and it's going to be a picket fence.
Yes.
And I'm going to be the perfect mom. We're going to have this perfect family.
Yes.
You give birth to this baby that has autism, which they can't show love very easily.
No.
So you're hoping that this is going to be the most cuddliest, loving,
and it's so opposite,
and it's going to give you, and it has to love you unconditionally, and it doesn't,
and he doesn't want to be touched.
And so there's something different. So you're thinking, maybe it's me, maybe it's genetic. Okay, you have a second child.
Yeah.
Now the second child has like physical
issues,
and then you realize that your first child has issues that maybe that are beyond your control, because you must have had some insecurities about, why is my child not giving me as much cuddles and kissing?
Always thought it was me, because he would. It's interesting because they do take to one person, and he would let my ex-husband touch him, and he wouldn't let me touch him.
That would be like just
horrible. It was the hardest thing. And then when I did touch him, he would rub it off on the carpet. And he would rub it so much that he would make himself bleed from carpet burn. And he would start screaming, XOXO hot, XOXO hot, XOXO repeatedly. This is after it became verbal, because he wasn't always extremely verbal.
Wait, I can't do anything right.
I just think, oh my gosh. I was at that point where I'm like, oh Lord. Right?
Why
I was definitely in this mentality of why did this happen to me? And I was depressed. As much as my ex-husband was supportive, he worked a lot. And whether he admits it or not, and he knows it, he drank an awful lot. And he was always out almost every single night, after work or doing whatever. And then when he did get home, he was in a grumpy mood, and then he would be fine after he had a drink, after he had his first drink.
You probably preferred him when he was drinking.
Totally.
Right? Because he was nicer and sweeter.
I joke about it to this day. You know, I'll be like, are you grumpy? You know, have you had your drink yet?
So, right.
Yeah. And I'm not, I don't know. Like, I'll joke and say whether he was an alcoholic. I don't know.
So you feel awfully alone.
I do.
At this point.
I feel alone. And you know what? When I look at it, I mean, why would you want to be around somebody like that? Right? Like, why do you
I can see it. I can see it that way. Yeah. But I can also say that, because that's what you sign up for.
You did sign up for it.
Yeah.
You did. I mean,
and
at any point you could have left.
And it's his genetics too, with the child.
It is. And it's a hard, it's a lot to take in. And I used to joke, and I remember the neighbors joking a lot with him as well. Back when we were in London, because I did a lot with the boys, and we would say I was the maid, I was the plumber, I was the electrician, I was the grass cutter, I was the
everything.
I was everything. I ran that house, and I remember I was in the backyard, and I was picking up the dog poo, and he said, and our neighbors, his name is John at the time, great guy, and he's like, can I make a suggestion? He said, I want you to pick up that dog poo, put it in a bag, and put it under your husband's pillow. And I just sort of laughed it off, right? So, yeah, because I was doing
everything.
I was his mom as well. I picked up after him all the time.
So alone.
Like, I did everything for him, you know?
Full of probably a lot of negative self-talk.
Very much. Like, a lot of self-talk.
I deserve all this, or I don't even deserve to live in this house. And
the problem was, when it got really bad for me, was after Jacob was born, my last.
Yeah, because let's go back. So you decided to have a third.
Was that? my last with him, I should say, because I have four.
Yes.
Yes.
But the third, was that a shock? Was that a surprise?
So he was a surprise.
Yes.
Okay. He was a surprise, and actually he wasn't wanted.
So
he wasn't wanted at all by my ex-husband. He actually asked me to have an abortion, and he knows it. He actually asked me to, but I didn't. And I remember we were not getting along, and, you know, things were not good between us. And I remember it was Halloween night, and that's the night that he told his mother, and I could hear his mother on his phone saying, "Why? Why?" But we went through with the pregnancy.
Because everybody's probably thinking, are you fucking insane, Sandra? Are you nuts? Sandra? Are you nuts?
Another baby?
You've got so much shit on your plate. And you're like, nope.
Yeah. Nope, so we, and you know what? It's interesting because we weren't intimate very, like, ever. And the one time that we are, I'm pregnant. So that was tough. That was really tough. And the pregnancy wasn't a good one because I actually got sick. So I ended up with placenta previa. So we were moving from our old house into our new house. And I went to pick up a box, and I was 32 weeks pregnant, and I hemorrhaged. I hemorrhaged and went to the hospital and wasn't detecting any other ultrasound before, but to found out that I had a low-lying placenta. So my placenta was underneath the baby, which is very dangerous.
Okay.
So back in the day, that's why a lot of people died of childbirth.
Okay.
Because they delivered the placenta first, and you can't really do that. So a lot of people have placenta previa. No, so I'm being followed by my doctor for pregnancy.
From, like, in Mike's or?
No, just Joseph Brandt in Burlington.
Joseph Brandt, okay, okay.
Yeah. And so I find out I have placenta previa, I'm still bleeding. I end up getting steroid shots. So it's steroid shots that they put in your bum.
And they really make you happy.
They do. They make you happy, but the other
they
was...
They make you really fucking angry.
They were straight. They like, do. Like emotions all over the board. Steroid shots.
They've been saying to me, Carla, for my cancer,
yep.
You know, we can put you on steroid shots. I'm like, no fucking way. I don't want to be on them. They fuck up your hormones and your moods and forget
But
it.
I had to because I had to strengthen his lungs.
Of course you had to.
I had to strengthen his lungs. Yes. What if, in case they
and
had
that's
to
the last thing you need
deliver.
Now is steroid shots. Okay.
Yeah, so here I am. They're giving me steroid shots. They give me a choice between bed rest or the hospital for the rest of my pregnancy.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, flip. I have two kids at home. One of them that's constantly at Sick Kids Hospital. The other one that has something going on that's not diagnosed yet, but we're trying to figure out what's going on. Here I am on bed rest. Thank goodness for my ex-sister-in-law and my mother-in-law at the time.
So did they just step in?
They helped. They stepped right in. My mother-in-law was there doing the laundry, helping me with the kids, my boys.
She was amazing. So you decided to do bed rest at home.
I wanted to be at home. Yes, I wanted to be there with my kids. I didn't want to be stuck in a hospital. So I am at home.
But it's also scary because if you do too much activity, you could kill your child.
Totally.
So
you have to be
scary.
Really careful. Yeah. So you have to be, you really have to listen to the doctors. And having my ex-mother-in-law there and my ex-sister-in-law there, I really was forced to stay in my bed.
Well, I think what's hard, you probably looked really good. You just look like a pregnant lady.
I did.
And I find that with my cancer, I look healthy.
You look amazing.
So people assume I can do what I used to be able to do.
Yeah.
So I feel guilty that I'm not helping pick up boxes. And you probably went through that same thing.
Oh, totally.
Like laying in the bed. And the guilt of going, oh my God, I'm letting everybody do all this for me because I've gotten to know you over a short period. But since I got diagnosed, I saw you only about a month after that. You know, you're very much a giver.
Yes.
So it must have been horrible for you to be bed rest and
have
to receive.
Thing. Yeah. So they're doing all this. And my sister-in-law would be there almost every weekend because my ex worked. He had his own business. So he was 7 days a week. They end up inducing me at 37 weeks. So we took him out. That was hard. Now it was interesting because that was it. So I remember the day that Jacob was born and the day after they sent me home and I was dropped off at the house and my ex-husband literally dropped me off and went to work.
Oh my God.
So here I am with Nathan, Joshua, and Jacob.
Oh my gosh.
Just had a baby. And he
and
has to go to work.
You don't know if
you're
going to have postpartum at this point.
I have no idea.
You have to assume you're going to have it.
Yes. I didn't really with Josh though.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think because of his medical issues.
Yes, it kept you too focused on him.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I was really focused on
Jacob. So with Jacob, did you have?
So Jacob, he was a lot of work. He wasn't a bad baby, if you will. Not that baby is bad. When I say bad, I mean like crying all the time. Mm-hmm. He didn't, but I ended up becoming quite depressed because not mentioning that before this, I even had Jacob. I was running a full-time daycare as well.
That's right.
I was running a full-time daycare.
And the reason you set up the home-based daycare so that you could be at home with your kids.
Yes, yes. I always knew I wanted to work with children, hence doing the ECE before I even had kids of my own. And then actually after Nathan was born, I actually went to school in London to finish. So I always knew that the future of children, working with children some way, somehow, was always in something I wanted to do. So I did. I ended up, after Nathan was born, started tutoring, actually. I started tutoring some children. And just one lady, she asked me how I felt about looking after her daughter all day. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? And then it sort of just grew from there. It stemmed from there. And that's how I ended up opening up my my own daycare. And it's interesting because mat leave was only 6 months at the time. Back then, the child care regulations that you have now are of 2 under 2 and all that was not in effect. So you could have 5, but the ages did not matter. They were all really little. So I had 5 other babies, plus my own kids as well.
Did you have a helper?
No, it was just me. So after Jacob was born, I didn't really take any time off. I took a couple weeks, and then I went right back into it. That's when the depression really started kicking. And
so during the day, you have to be happy.
I really have to be happy. And I'm trying so hard. Nathan is in JK. Nathan's in school, so he's out of the house during the day. Joshua isn't. Jacob's just a baby. And it was, so Jacob was born in May, so this is like going back into September. So I did have the whole summer with all the kids. But, you know, it's hard because I'm trying to be as happy as I possibly can be. But I ended up losing a significant amount of weight. I was, I think, 83 pounds. So I was literally a walking skeleton. And I was so skinny. And I remember it was interesting because it was joked about a lot. And I was always very self-conscious about it. I never knew why I was losing all this weight. And I remember going to doctor after doctor, testing my thyroid, doing all these things, putting me on like Boost and nothing. I couldn't gain any of my weight back. And I know my ex-husband was very unattracted. He was not attracted to me whatsoever because I look like a skeleton, like you could see my ribs and everything. And I know now that it was depression. And I probably was not eating the way that I should have been eating. I mean, when you're that depressed, you don't eat. You let your hunger go, and you're looking after that many kids, you don't eat either.
To not be envious of how you lose weight when you're depressed, because I just eat.
So it's the opposite, right?
Yeah, so I'm like,
it's the opposite.
How many more things?
And
I
maybe
stuff
I
in my
would
face?
Have if I didn't have all these kids around me.
Yes.
Maybe I would have been the opposite. If I was,
I think you have a very disciplined personality.
I don't know.
So I don't think you would.
That I have a disciplined personality, right? Which is something that I have learned. So Jacob is around, and how things really went sour in our previous marriage was, I remember one day, so Joshua had all these medical conditions and he had a feeding tube. So Joshua was fed by a tube after his surgeries, and it was really difficult to get him back into the school system because with this tube, there was risks involved. I had to go through the Board of Education, so it was like a nightmare to get him back in, but I did. I got him back into the school system. And his feeding tube came out quite often, and there was times where we were able to put it back in, but there were times where we weren't able to. So the one day that we were not able to, unfortunately, we had to go to SickKids, and they have to put him under, and you have to go through this procedure where they have to, it's kind of got in through guided imaging, so they do have to reopen the whole cord a little bit out, put the lining back in, because the lining's pretty deep inside the stomach, right? It's not just on the outside. So it does start to close. Even the smallest little amount, you can't get it back in. So he comes home that night, and he's in this big kindergarten performance, and he plays a role, a part, a pretty big part in this play. And he's like, Mom, I really need to be at school the next day. So I made this deal with his dad that the only way he could go to school was if he drove him and he picked him up. Because typically I would walk them every morning, and it's about 20 minutes, and then I would pick them up. And unfortunately, there is a snowstorm that day. So Peter does drop them at school, but I get a call from the school saying that nobody is here to pick them up. And I have all the daycare, and there is a major snowstorm. And I have to walk all the way to school, which took me 45 minutes to get there.
And what do you do with all
these, they're coming with me. I have the wagon. I'm pushing a stroller and I'm pulling a wagon. And I'm trying to get through deep snow. I finally get to the school. I get the boys, and Josh can't walk. So I have to put him on the handlebars of the stroller. We walk back, which takes me another hour and a half. By then, all the parents are waiting at my door because it's almost 6 o'clock at this point. So Peter's still MIA. I tried calling him. There's no answer. He would always ignore. He got home that night, and that was the end of it. And he did get really mad that night, and I just, because I think I had said to Nathan that that's the night I had said when they were asking where their daddy is, and I said, your dad's out drinking, right? I guess I just had enough, and I was just straight up honest, and probably shouldn't have said that at the time, but I just, but no, I was done.
That's pretty normal, yeah.
It's like, he's drinking. Yes. And I remember him coming home, and it was late at night, and he went upstairs to kiss the boys goodnight, and it was like 11 o'clock. And he said, you told Nathan I was drinking, and I said, yeah, I did. And that was it, and he got mad and angry, and unfortunately it was not pretty. And that was basically the end of our relationship, and we basically stayed in separate rooms from that point on. And then we separated. And
so you're a single mom now. You've got three kids.
Yep, so now I have three kids.
And the youngest is challenging.
So
beginning to show signs.
Beginning to show signs. So he actually showed it with Peter and I were together because he was suffering from severe separation anxiety. Not even in the smallest bit, severe to the point where, and it was to his dad. To the point where his dad couldn't even go into the bathroom without him being at his foot. His dad would have to honk a certain period of times before he left the driveway. Like, it was just, it was so bad. And I'm now worried, so I do seek help for Jacob. And I reach out, and, you know, we try to get resources and everything for him. He finally starts school. We have a psychological assessment done, and he's diagnosed with what's called a nonverbal learning disability. So his input is not there. Like, he's not able to take in anything. So, yes, he's verbal, but what they mean by nonverbal learning disability is not able to comprehend anything that is happening.
So does it have to be all in writing?
Nope. It's just his memory is not there. Like, he needs constant repetition, which he's having a very difficult time processing. His memory processing skills are just not there.
I mean, that's
there.
Okay. Kids are different ages.
Yeah.
You're running a daycare.
Yeah.
There's all different learning disabilities that are happening.
Yeah.
You are trying to process what happened with you as a child.
Yeah.
And not bring that upon how you parent.
Yeah.
So you're trying to learn how to parent the right way.
Yes. So before Peter and I had split, I was trying to learn how to parent the right way. And how that happened for me was I fell ill. As I mentioned, I was really skinny. So, like, I guess the smallest little cold, flu, would turn into something pretty significant. And I actually ended up with meningitis. I was in the hospital for a period of time. And that was life-changing for me because I received a phone call from my mom's side of the family, my uncle. He said to me, listen, kiddo, and I know you've heard this before, but you need to apply the oxygen mask on yourself before you apply it on your kids.
Yeah.
In other words, as we know, take care of you.
Yes.
Which is something I was not doing.
Yes.
I was revolving my life around my children and my daycare. That was my life. I did not have a life. I never went out. I never did anything for myself. Barely had any friends. I had one girlfriend down the street that I spoke to a lot who was aware of everything that was happening and always wanted me to get out of the relationship. But never really had a life. And it's interesting because as mean as this sounds, and I know he regrets it now. Max has a lot of regrets about our relationship. Is he always told me that nobody would ever want to date a skeleton, especially one with baggage. So that always played in my head. So that's one of the reasons why I think I stuck it out. And it's interesting because his mom wanted me to leave him at periods of time. She was actually going to find a place for me and the kids, looking with me. But that fell through. And I remember my ex-sister-in-law saying to me every other weekend. In other words, he'll finally get a taste of what you're going through. You'll get a little bit of a break.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's what happened. And I got out of the hospital, and that's when I realized. I think I became a stronger person, where I started to stand up for myself a little bit more. I started to take care of myself. I had the opportunity to start reading book after book. Nathan's still really young. Nathan's diagnosed with autism. I have no idea what autism is. Doctor tells me, you know, that he'll never be able to socialize like any other child. His academic level will never be as good as any other child. He'll always be grades below mentally, academically. And I was like, okay, what do you do? Fortunately, at the time, the wait list for any services for a child who was had autism, which wasn't really known back then, was so long. To hire anybody to do any services, ABA, which is now what I am trained in, was $150 an hour, and he would need invasive treatment, so about 40 hours a week. How do you afford that? So that wasn't even an option for me. So here I am reading book after book after book after book. I ended up finding a lady who did do some therapy with him for a lot less rate, which inspired me to take my behavioral background to a whole different level. And I decided to go back to school. And that's when I studied ABA therapy as well. So I was really able to get into Nathan's head, really working with Nathan day in and day out. I developed structure. I developed routine. I realized okay, everything that I'm doing is not working, because if it was, I would not be feeling the way that I'm feeling.
Yeah.
How can I make this different? What can I do? And it was hard because they were so set on their ways, the ways that I was with them, not following through with my kids. I bribed them a lot. Different things that was not working, and I just changed everything around, and I started to notice a huge difference in my kids and in my parenting.
I mean, if we fast forward to today,
yeah,
if we look at, you know, your upbringing, we look at your experiences,
yes,
and then we look at who you are today,
you would probably never know.
Never know.
Never know.
Right?
Yeah.
Because today you have...
Today I have my own practices. Yeah. So I...
You have a happy, healthy marriage. Yeah,
very happy, healthy marriage. I found my soulmate. He calls us cosmic mates beyond.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the easiest getting together with him, but it was meant to be.
And that's a lot for him to take on.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Like, but he found me. He says I was his silhouette that he's always dreamed about.
Yeah. I mean, he had a crush on you in high school.
He had a crush on me.
And so he sees you as that girl he fell in love with in high school.
He does. He said that he would see me at, so he was in high school because he dated my best friend's younger sister, and he always said that he had a crush on me. It was interesting because I was attracted to his mind. Mm-hmm. And that was new for me because I was so intrigued by how smart he was. And
it's pretty attractive when a guy falls in love with your kids who have who have a lot of issues to deal with.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because when you are a single mom, it's an interview process. You're not just going out with anybody. It's like, how would you be around my children? How would you accept all this? And he did. And I'm sure it wasn't easy. And I know it was hard because...
I mean, one of the things he wanted, which is interesting, which you gave to him...
Yes, is a child of his own.
Is a child of his own, yeah. Right? Yeah. You have your beautiful little girl.
I do. I have Chloe. And she's been such a delight in our lives. She's been the boy's princess. She was always meant to be. She was always... I mean, she's just an amazing soul.
So you have this beautiful home now.
Yes.
You know, you're in a nice, great neighborhood.
Yes.
So you do have the picket fence.
I do.
Although it took a long time to get there.
Yes, yes.
You've got... You know, you got your dog.
Yes.
Right? You got your home business set up.
Yes.
That's flourishing.
It's flourishing, yes. And
the kind of work you do... I mean, what you're doing with me is not perhaps... traditionally what you do with everyone else,
right.
But you are willing to work with me
because
you're that type of person.
Yep. And because I knew I could help.
Yes.
I knew I could help you. And, you know, it's interesting because I just don't take on anybody either, right? Like, it has to be on both ends, right? Like, it has to connect, it has to work. And, you know, I love doing what I do. I'm so passionate about it. So this girl who used to wake up every single day with this mentality of why me, to a mentality of, aha, that's why me. Mm-hmm. This is why I'm here. This is my purpose.
Yes.
And it's interesting because I don't have regrets. Mm-hmm. I don't have any regrets. I'm not mad at anybody. I'm not mad at my dad. I'm not mad at my uncle. I maybe don't choose to have people in my life. And that's fine. I'm fine with that. I forgive, you know, and I think forgiveness is huge. I don't have to.
No, that's right.
I don't have to forgive. It's
it
my
sure
choice.
Feels great when you do, though, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I forgive. I mean, I look at it, not maybe. I know everything happened for a reason. I know I was the one meant to go through all that. Perhaps maybe there's somebody that wouldn't have come out as strong, if you will. Maybe they would have taken their life a long time ago. But I didn't.
I mean, really, I think when I hear your story, that's what sometimes I think in my head is like, God, that would have been so easy to just
take
your own life.
It's the easy route.
And yeah, it is a pretty easy route, right?
But what would I be teaching my children?
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
That's not how you do it. There's no easy way out. And you really have to face things head on. And I think that's why I'm different than, you know, because of my background, like I said, is behavioral development. And I work with a lot of children with behavioral issues and families that are having a lot of issues inside their household with themselves or with, you know, them as a couple or with their children. And I think the reason why my help is completely different than any psychologist, psychiatrist, is anything that you see is that, A, I get it. I lived it. I get it. I understand it completely what you're going through. Let me show you what worked for me. And B, because I work directly inside families' homes, they're not mm-hmm. sitting behind my desk telling me their story and saying, oh, sorry, time's up. Mm-hmm. You know, move on to the next client. And I mean, it's great that there are psychologists and psychologists out there, and I'm sure they're great with what they do. The difference is that I'm with the family. I get to live their life with them. I get to feel what they're doing. I get to hear everything that's going on. So I really get a full feel of the family situation. And it's interesting because is there an easy fix? No. But if I would have known now what I know then, would I have gone through the same thing that I did with my kids? Probably not. But that's okay. Now I know. Now I'm here to educate other parents and say there it doesn't have to be this way. You do not have to be stressed out raising your children. It's easier than what you think it is. There's such a stigma when it comes to parenting that everybody, I see it all over mom groups constantly, and I see stressed out parents talking about their children and my terrible twos and the toddler years and my teenager. And I'm like, but it doesn't have to be that way. It stems from you as a parent and how you display yourself to your child. And not only that, how do you follow through as a parent? Children crave structure. They crave routine. They crave consistency. Children do not want to be bribed. And that is happening all the time. Children need these life skills that are so important.
Have you had some parents say to you, no, my child is just especially difficult, or my child has learning disabilities that make it difficult?
The time.
And I guess from your standpoint, you can say,
I get it.
I get it. And you can't one up me.
I
got a lot going on in my house.
It's
and
I think once parents realize, and they do hear a bit of my story, and I don't go into complete detail, they realize that, okay, she's got something here.
You've got a lot on your plate. Like if you look at, you have still have your after school program.
I do.
You have with your kids.
I do.
And you have how many kids are?
It varies. I can have 10 to 12. And it's interesting because I'll get people say, how do you handle that? How do you handle all those kids? And
but like, you have a way of keeping them completely calm.
It's completely calm.
You can
and
just,
they respect me.
Yes.
I don't deal with any of the behaviors that if I have certain children in my yoga program or after school program or whatever it is, I don't see any of that these parents see. It's interesting.
And is that because
they
you really listen?
To them. They know I'm in tune, and I'm also an example to them. I don't act out in any way.
Yes.
That is uncontrollable in front of the children. Children are a product to some degree of what they live.
Yes.
We can teach our children to control their emotions.
But yet you were.
Yes.
And you changed that.
Yes. So I know what I was bringing out on my kids. I saw it firsthand. I'm living proof.
Yeah, like you are living proof. And
yes.
I think, you know, when I first met you and I was like, okay, so who are you? What do you, you know, what's your story? Of course, because I'm
always
intrigued.
That's
a curious person. And you run a few different businesses. Then you have all these kids with issues. I'm like, how do you never have time to have romance with your husband? And you say, we just make it work.
We always make it work. Yeah, we do. We find time for each other. And I think that's really important. And it's interesting because that's one of the things I do work on with parents is the connection. The connection is so important for your children to see. And, you know, I didn't have that with my ex-husband. We didn't connect like that, like my husband and I do, especially in front of the kids.
Yes.
My daughter sees a very healthy relationship. We don't yell and scream at each other. We deal with things in a calm manner. And if we do have issues, they are dealt with without her presence. And I do an observation period with the family. And, you know, as minor as it may seem to the parent, the child picks up on the smallest thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're watching you. So if you're bringing in your negative energy from your day at work because you had a bad day, your child is picking up on that negativity. And the more they hear you talk negative, be it about a coworker or your boss or anybody, you've now just taught your child that this is how we talk about people, that this is what life is about. Instead of bringing up the negativity, why not look for the positive component? And it's what we're not programmed to do.
You teach that with the kids, which is amazing. What you and I are going to do is different because now you're dealing with an adult that's...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm generally a pretty positive person. I try to be positive. I like to see the positive.
Yeah, you do.
Being in pain is what sometimes can make me not feel so positive.
Yeah.
But what I really got from you in the our sessions is that I think you're the first person that's been able to lead me through the beginnings of mindfulness.
Yeah. Aww, that's
because
great to hear.
My brain is usually racing a million times and I don't know how to make it stop.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how to stop the negative self-talk.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm afraid to be too alone with my thoughts because I don't want that to creep back up and be like, you know, maybe you deserve this cancer. Maybe you didn't do enough and enough of anything, you know, like it's just like the self-talk that comes up, like just the negativity.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to beat cancer, beat it with a negative mind.
No, you cannot.
So I feel like cancer is allowing me to be selfish.
Mm.
Which I felt guilty about before.
Yes.
So it's allowing me, I feel, to like have time with you to do mindfulness and not feel guilty that I should be doing something else. Or having sessions with you while you're helping me feel closer and more connected to my body.
Yes.
Because right now there's like aliens in my body.
Living
I feel like these little tiny like gremlins that are like just running around having this big, huge party.
Yeah.
And causing these aches and pains, and I haven't accepted.
Right, that they're there.
Yeah, and my cancer, and just meditate on, not to meditate, like stretch and push and like be okay to feel my cancer.
Right, and it is okay. And our minds are programmed to think negative thoughts.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because we always look for the negative before we look for the positive. But once we, as humans, can learn to change that process of thinking, it's amazing what can happen to you physically, mentally, emotionally. It's a hard thing to do. And I know, and I'm one to say, it is one of the hardest things ever had to do in my life. But the minute I changed my pattern of thinking is the minute my weight came back, I felt like a completely different person. I didn't get up in the morning saying, ugh, why me? I got up in the morning saying, all right, I got this. I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like cancer has brought me really amazing people into my life. It's really
Everything
interesting.
Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we spoke about that in at the beginning of your sessions.
With amazing people that I haven't connected with in years.
Yeah.
And I think I wish everybody could experience having a terminal disease for just 1 week and see their life.
Yeah. How it just changes.
And God, they would know. They would know how to separate the bullshit versus the shit that matters.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I could just say it. I wish I could just say it to someone, but I feel like you don't need that to happen to you.
No. I hear what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying because I see it all the time because I can be at the back of the room and I could be listening to people and I can hear them talking about all the crap. And I just, in the head, I'm just shaking my head, you know, and I'm like, stop. Just stop the negative talk, you know, and anytime somebody's talking negative, I try to listen. I really do. But at the same time, I have going through my head, just please try to see the positive,
try to see the positive. I wish I could bottle up my cancer and just say, God, you would, you would see things. You would just like not care about half that shit that you
wouldn't
care about.
Right. Right?
Yeah. And
you
not
wouldn't.
Be afraid to say things that normally you were
afraid of
saying.
I had so much fear to confront my dad, to confront my family. I have no fear, as a matter of fact.
So that's what's amazing.
I would
you didn't need to get terminal disease to tell you this.
No, I didn't. But I would love for my uncle, who was the one that sexually abused me, to pick up the phone and call me because I'm no longer fearful of you.
Yes.
That was Stand Up, Speak Up founder Carla Stevens Tolstoy speaking with Parenting Solutions practitioner Sandra Dowick. To learn more about Sandra's practices, visit www.parentingsolutions.ca. Follow Carla's cancer journey on social media using the Instagram handle @StandUpSpeakUpApparel. And remember, none of this is possible without your support. Help Carla help others by making a purchase at StandUpSpeakUpApparel.com and find something to not only make you look great, but help someone in need. Want to send a personal note to Carla? Email her at Carla.Tolstoy@StandUpSpeakUp.ca. That's Carla.Tolstoy@StandUpSpeakUp.ca. That's all for this episode of My Boobs Are Trying to Kill Me, a Stand Up Speak Up podcast. I'm your guest host, Amanda D'Souza. Thank you for joining us. And if you love what you heard today, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts.
My boobies are scheming, my boobies are dreaming. With stage 4 cancer, they're trying to kill me. Drop me in the deep sea, better in the first degree, invading my body, bringing me to my knees. But I'm not quitting, no, I'm not giving in. I'm gonna be okay, I'm fighting all the way.
I'm Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people. He stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.